these types of chants, you know, affect people, cause this internal scream, well, am I an American? Am I an American?
The president pours kerosene and then strikes a match and then puts a blowtorch to the tinderbox that is America. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. A chat group involving the governor of Puerto Rico reveals entrenched corruption, partisanship, and disdain for the governed.
That's what we've been learning for the past 25, 30 years, but everything has come crashing down in this moment.
Also, YouTube is a haven for the alt-right, but popular left-wing hosts are trying to change that.
My persona seemed unexpectedly cool and self-deprecating and edgy. In other words, just drastically the opposite of what you expect from a so-called social justice warrior.
It's all coming up after this.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is out. I'm Brooke Gladstone. We know where it started. Those tweets last Sunday from America's president aimed at four Democratic congresswomen, all American citizens, all women of color, all impolitic in their impatience for change.
So here's the tweet.
Why don't they go back and help fix the totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came?
These places need your help badly. You can't leave fast enough. I'm sure that Nancy Pelosi would be very happy to quickly work out free travel arrangements.
And we know where it went. On Wednesday, Trump watched as his audience at a rally chanted, "Send her back," about Minnesota Rep. Ilhan Omar, who responded Thursday by calling Trump a fascist. The GOP scrambled all week to excuse and explain. On CNN, host Chris Cuomo asked the Kansas Republican Senate candidate and Trump ally Kris Kobach, "What if the president just came out and said, I am a racist?
Would you still support him
really?
As president?
You
have
I don't
to think
know.
About
that would be
it.
A really tough
you
question.
Have to
if
think
said,
about
said,
whether
said,
or not you would support a racist? Really?
I'd have to know who was running against him.
A racist?
Look.
While the press pursued the question of whether the president's comments would matter to his base, Ibram X. Kendi, founding director of American University's Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center, pursued another question in The Atlantic. Am I an American?
In 1787, the year the Constitution was drafted, Thomas Jefferson published in English his most famous and influential book, The Notes of the State of Virginia. There was a chapter called Laws, and one of the laws he proposed was the law of colonization, that enslaved blacks should be freed, civilized, and ultimately sent back to Africa, because the idea of a free black person for him in this country spelled Armageddon.
Because?
Because I guess he could not conceive of us creating anti-racist policies of equal opportunity, and attacks and ideas back and forth between whites and blacks would ultimately lead to this race war. For him, the solution was, let's just get rid of the black people who, of course, we brought against their will, and let's get rid of them against their will.
And the repatriation that was proposed wasn't back to the place of the family's origin.
When black people are told, go back to Africa, most black people will be like, exactly where would I go? I mean, I've traveled to West Africa, I've traveled to Ghana, and I don't feel as if I'm home. West Africans don't see me as one of them, just as Americans don't see me as one of them. And that's why I talked in that piece about this sort of envy. African Americans on some level have long been sort of searching for a nationality because we have not been made to feel as if we are American. And there's nowhere else in the world that, of course, we could consider home. And a certain segment of African Americans have said, we are American, and because we're an American, we deserve to be free. We deserve equal rights. While another segment of African Americans have said, we are not Americans, because if we were American, we would have freedom. We would have equal rights.
Where do you fall?
Both ring true to me.
This go back where you came from trope. You say it was right there in Jefferson's book, later the American Colonization Society in 1816.
The American Colonization Society was founded in Washington, D.C., and a who's who of American power came to witness its founding. The idea that the way to solve this Negro problem was to get rid of Black people, that was widespread. And this organization would become the most powerful race relations organization of the 19th century before the Civil War. Abraham Lincoln, even during the Civil War, was urging African Americans to return to Africa.
You mentioned Lincoln. He said that colonization had to happen because the Black race could never, quote, be placed on an equality with the white race. And he was swiftly corrected by the abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison. That really got to me. He said back in 1862, it is not their color, but their being free that makes their presence here intolerable.
And that's what caused me to ask, am I only an American when I act like a slave? Because what we're really speaking about here in the events of the last week is not just four congresswomen of color. These are people who are demanding an equal seat at the table. But when we have been willing to submit to white power, when we have looked away from racial inequality and racist policies, people don't tell us to go back to Africa.
We have a quote from Kellyanne Conway.
Forget these four. They represent a dark underbelly in this country of people who are not respecting our troops, are not giving them the resources and the respect that they deserve.
So therefore, because they're not giving the respect that they deserve, apparently they're supposed to leave. I think one of the ways we should understand this is if I was, for instance, to go to your house and start belittling everything or many things that I saw, you would look at me and say, how dare you come into my house and belittle what you see? You might as well leave. But what if it was my house too? Don't you want to make your house better? Isn't it your responsibility to do so? But for people who do not conceive of it as your house too, because they conceive of the house as white, they're going to say, love it or leave it.
You lay out in your piece very carefully how we've been here before. Your colleague in The Atlantic, Adam Serwer, wrote that he wanted to be very clear that America has not been here before. I mean, he stands squarely with the idea that white nationalism has been a governing doctrine for most of our existence as a country, that racist demagogues have occupied the White House before. But he said, we have never seen an American president make a U.S. representative, a refugee, an American citizen, a woman of color, and a religious minority an object of hate for the political masses in a deliberate attempt to turn the country against his fellow Americans who share any of those traits.
I actually do think it's something new, but I think we should also understand that the way racism presents itself, the way racists present themselves, they are essentially changing with the times. What Trump is doing is, as Adam stated, unprecedented. You know, you can simultaneously have a history of white nationalists governing in this country and each generation of white nationalists governing differently, or the way in which white nationalism is showing itself can be unprecedented.
Where do you think we are in the continuum of American racism?
I try not to actually think of a single continuum, but I actually think of a dueling continuum. And so one is the continuum of racial progress, how for certain people, things have progressed. But alongside racial progress has been racist progress, in which ideas and policies have become more sophisticated over time. If Obama came to represent for many people racial progress, for many people they're seeing Trump as the embodiment of racist progress.
When the press ran after Republican lawmakers this week, wondering whether what happened would finally be enough to peel some of them away, Most of them declined to do so or even to call it racism. They were trying to snatch the blatant remark out of the air and feed it backwards through the dog whistle. I mean, here are Reps Liz Cheney and House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy recasting Trump's racism as something else.
I want to make absolutely clear that our opposition to our socialist colleagues has absolutely nothing to do with their gender, with their religion, or with their race. It has to do with the content of their policies.
I believe that. I believe this is about ideology. This is about socialism versus freedom.
Saying that it was about socialism, that felt familiar to me.
Read any biography of Martin Luther King, who, of course, now is widely praised by Republicans, let alone Democrats. This was someone who was constantly classified by the ideological ancestors of current Republicans as communist for his anti-racist activism.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing the very same thing as the people who they look up to in the 60s at the very moment that they're trying to embrace King. But the same thing happened to abolitionists, right? You know, abolitionists advocating for immediate emancipation were denigrated and viewed as if they were attacking the American way of life and attacking what was essential to America. And of course, that is what also happened during Black Lives Matter, that these people weren't saying, you know what, we should value life equally. We should value Black life. No, they're going after people. They're attacking people. This is a classic defense that the very people who are engaging in the assaults, presenting themselves as the victims in the way police officers normally do.
It strikes me that the storm comes the same week as the Justice Department's announcement that it wouldn't be bringing federal civil rights charges against one of the officers involved in Eric Garner's death in New York City in Staten Island. Attorney General Barr made the decision the day before the fifth anniversary of his death.
I am very angry. I stand here in the spirit of my sister, who fought for justice until her dying day for my father. So no, there won't be no calm. No, there won't be no peace. No justice, no peace.
You've talked about how focusing on ignorance ignores the root of what racism really is about. Have we been focusing on the wrong news all week?
We should recognize and focus on the actual policies that are being justified by these ideas of go back to your country. Mass deportations of people. I'm talking about people who are being mass incarcerated, people who are being killed by the police, and that police officer never facing justice. I'm talking about people who are being disenfranchised and demoralized. These are many different forms of policies that are effectively removing people from the body politic of America. I see a very clear line between go back to your country and a police officer choking to death an unarmed Black man. So that young man is essentially gone back into the soil. And that is deemed okay, obviously, because the police officer is still on the force. There's a very clear line I see. And so it's not surprising that the same Trump administration has decided to not pursue civil rights charges for Eric Garner's killer and is also telling four congresswomen of color to go back to their country.
You have a book coming out next month called How to Be an Anti-Racist. And you wrote, we know how to be racist. We know how to pretend to be not racist. Now let's know how to be anti-racist. You think it's possible?
Without question, I think it's possible because of how I define and how we define racist and anti-racist. Again, it's not who a person is. There's no tattoo on a person's head. Well, maybe some people. But people are not born racist. This is not their identity. It is what they are doing. It is what they are saying. And people can say and do things differently.
One last question. When all of this happened this past week, in your article in The Atlantic, you talked a little bit about this sort of inner screaming that was going on. And I wondered if you could just describe how you felt as the week went on.
Well, as the week went on, which of course was a week that in many ways was representative of a lifetime, those constant shouts of go back to your country causes some people to ask the question, well, is this my country? And in many ways, it's a scream because, of course, you don't even want to hear that. You don't even want to be asking that question because you don't know anywhere else, right? These types of chants, you know, affect people, cause this internal scream. Well, am I an American? Am I an American? And of course, people end up probably saying, yes, I'm an American. I'm just as American as anyone else. But other people never even have to question whether they're an American.
I'm sorry you have to keep explaining that.
It's okay. And I think that's one of the reasons why I wrote that piece, because I wanted to give people a window, you know, a way to get into people's minds, how they're taking in the last week, specifically looking at America's history. So we have to be willing to step into other people's shoes and to be empathetic. That's essential to being anti-racist.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Dr. Ibram X. Kendi is director of American University's Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center and author of the book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, out next month. Coming up, Puerto Rico often serves as America's lab. Can a crisis in leadership on the island offer the mainland any lessons? This is On the Media.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. How can we stand on the moral foundations of our nation when they are built on such unstable ground? How broken does our political system have to be? How roiled by corruption and contempt for the governed before we find common purpose in repairing it? And if there is a limit to what we can tolerate, how might it look when that limit is reached? For that answer, we turn to Puerto Rico, where for the past week, protesters have turned out to demand the resignation of Governor Ricardo Rosselló.
We're tired of the cynicism. They put down women. They put down the LGBT community. People with disabilities. Corruption. It is insane. We are tired. We can't take it anymore.
Puerto Rican singer Ricky Martin on Wednesday, outside the Capitol in San Juan, joined by rappers, artists, athletes, and tens of thousands of others from both major political parties on the island. The protests began last weekend when the Center for Investigative Journalism in San Juan published some 900 pages of text messages between the governor, members of his administration, and a lobbyist exchanged on the Telegram app. This was one nasty chat.
The leaked chat room conversations between the governor and 11 others are laced with profane, homophobic, and sexist comments, and in one case, talk of violence against the mayor of San Juan, Carmen Yulín Cruz. The governor's chief financial officer, Christian Sobrino, wrote, "I'm dying to shoot her up." The governor responded, "You'd be doing me a big favor."
In one exchange, Governor Rosello called a former New York City councilwoman a whore.
Governor Ricardo Rosello is defying calls to resign and apologizing for his role in what has now been dubbed Ricky Leaks.
It's a scandal where 900 pages of conversations were leaked, showing the government manipulating media stories and trying to discredit negative press coverage.
It's like a window into the unconscious.
Pedro Reyna Perez is a journalist and historian with both the University of Puerto Rico and Harvard.
We have very little regard for public officials, and the chat basically gave us evidence that what we thought about them and what we thought they thought about us was true.
He says that for Puerto Ricans, pummeled by financial crisis, punishing austerity, and lagging recovery from the devastation of Hurricane Maria, learning that their own government mocks them has been too much to bear.
We have had a political class that has basically enslaved the rest of the island for their own economic interests. That's what we've been learning for the past 25, 30 years, but everything has come crashing down in this moment. We did not reach bankruptcy out of the blue.
The group of 12 men also mocked the poor and the dead from Hurricane Maria.
At some point, the number of corpses at the morgue in San Juan was so overwhelming that they had to be placed on the floor, and they mock the fact that corpses are on the floor. And at one point, Christian Sobrino, who was a participant in the chat and who was the chief financial officer for the government, basically said, "We need more corpses for our crows."
Meaning their critics.
I mean, I say it right now and I get goosebumps. This part is one of the elements that has brought forth so much public outrage. They can only talk about their interests. There is no expression in the chat about public concerns for the well-being, for economic recovery. No, it's just us.
The chats show public officials who are obsessed with re-election at any cost, manipulating media coverage and public perception, and using public funds to do it.
One thing that we suspected and was confirmed through the chat, they have a farm of trolls on social media. They were paying people to basically, you know, comment, take part in surveys, attack people that were critical of the government. And for me, that's one of the worst things that has come out of the chat. They were being paid to basically destruct the opposition, be it a political party or someone who dissented from the governor's positions.
They also make fun of several journalists, including a reporter who died in the hurricane. Jay Fonseca is a TV and radio host who is derided in the chat logs and whose investigations into corruption have made him stand out in the Puerto Rican media landscape. He says the chats weren't just shocking. They were never ending.
This is not the people that started their day eating breakfast, they go into a chat and do some jokes and then go to work. No, it was all the time. The governor has to resign because federal funding now is going to have even more supervision and more oversight that we already had. Thanks to this governor, because of corruption cases that were arrested recently, his Secretary of Education and basically the public health system director was arrested as well. I mean, we're talking about $5 billion in government spending. And we only have a $9 billion budget. So Basically 55% of the budget that was under this two people control, they were arrested last week. So now after these cases and this chat, even Democrats are asking for more oversight. So that means that the most vulnerable people here are going to suffer the most because they are the ones that receive federal funding.
On the chat, they discussed friendly journalists they could feed questions to.
They actually wrote that they have a journalist that they asked her to ask a question to Carmen Yulín, the mayor of San Juan. And they were doing that because they wanted Yulín to look bad. And she, that journalist, has government contracts. If someone gives me money and I have a contract with government,
yeah,
I cannot receive instructions from them to ask questions to their political enemies.
You're talking about basic conflict of interest.
That's a conflict of interest that I can see from a helicopter. My own radio station right now is conducting an investigation after I said on air that this guy at my radio station, a journalist, was implicated in the chat, and I had to say it. And now my radio station is conducting an investigation.
This past Tuesday, a studio audience on Telemundo chanted in support of you, reassuring you, saying the people are with you.
So I was going to promote my show and the most viewed show here in Puerto Rico, which is a comedy show that goes on air before my show. And I went walk to the other studio, and I was just walking, and people started clapping. Still hard for me to talk about it. Because, you know, it was one of the most beautiful moments in my life, for sure. And at the same time, it's sad, because I believe Puerto Rico is paradise. We have an amazing place. We have a great, great island. We just need to cooperate a little. And seeing the funds being thrown away or robbed, so shameful. So shameful.
Do you feel vindicated? You've been reporting about corruption for a long time.
Ah, wow. What a question. Vindication for me, yeah, some of that, I'm not going to lie. But it's justice for our sources that trusted us and that trust the media in Puerto Rico. That's why I'm so mad. I met the governor at his mansion, and I told him about sources that were going to come out and show their faces. That actually was about a prior administration, but they were still in their jobs, and the people that they were talking about were still working in government with this administration. And he promised me that he was going to protect my sources, and they showed their faces, and they were fired. They were fired. And I called him. He didn't answer. When people just tell you secrets that they know they're risking everything, and they just get fired, wow.
You felt it personally, deeply, when their careers were cut short by trying to be good citizens.
Exactly.
We're speaking on Wednesday. A protest is scheduled in about an hour from now demanding Rocio's resignation. This moment has been described as a Puerto Rican spring.
It's the first time I have seen people this mad. I had never seen it before. I mean, we are the island of enchantment. We have so many ways to have fun here that most of the people, they don't care. Most of the people are watching Netflix or just going to the beach. We do have beautiful places to go, and we do have really good restaurants. It's not an ad, but please come to Puerto Rico. You can check for yourself. But if you come here, you'll see that most people are disconnected because there's basically an easy way out. We just buy a ticket and go to live in Florida or New York or Texas. You can't just disconnect yourself. You know, no one wants to be listening negative things all the time. Not even me.
You said you've never seen people so mad before, that people are feeling reconnected again. We know that Trump likes to insult Puerto Rico, that the recovery funds have been and continue to be too little too late. The island has a history of rebuffs and humiliations from Washington. Do you think the depth of the offense of this chat is partly due to the fact that it's coming from inside the house, from the island's own government?
Sure, and from someone we never expected this kind of behavior. I mean, how can I talk to my daughter and tell her not to speak the way the governor does? Same thing happens with Trump, I know. But in this case, we never thought the governor of Puerto Rico was that kind of person.
Meanwhile, we've been confronting the kind of moral corruption that we have here, maybe focusing too much on the trivial, I don't know. Could you give us any advice with the benefit of a little bit of distance or having, as the president says, all that water around you?
I believe that the problem that we have is that we're preaching to our choir.
Yeah.
I mean, the problem is the rest. When that standing ovation happened, I got to see that we actually surpassed for the first time the top comedy show in Puerto Rico. So this is the first time ever we have had that kind of audience. We can tell that the rest of the people went to our show to educate themselves and then go out and fight in the street. So that's basically all we can do. Just tell others, just spread the word that democracy needs participation. There's no other way to do it. We have to participate. If not, it's going to fail sooner or later.
Jay, thank you very much.
Anytime.
Jay Fonseca is a radio and TV host in Puerto Rico. Coming up, far-right YouTube meets left tube and loses ground. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. We just heard Jay Fonseca urge the media to get out of their bubble. That's what some concerned citizens are doing on YouTube, making content that the algorithm delivers to the opposite bubbles by design. Free of old-school gatekeeping, YouTube hosts a wide political spectrum from the furthest right to the fringiest left, reaching some of the youngest eyes and ears. On the Media producer Micah Loewinger tells the story of three young viewers whose perspectives were changed and their identities shaped by their YouTube diets.
In 2016, YouTube turned a 16-year-old named Jake into a neo-Nazi.
No fascist in their right mind would ever identify as a neo-Nazi, but if you had to ask me to identify myself at the time, I think I would have said something stupid like a pan-nationalist white identitarian.
Based on what I've heard from others like him, Jake's radicalization was fairly standard. Like thousands of teenage boys, he was a big fan of the popular gamer PewDiePie. As YouTube's single biggest creator, he can have a pernicious effect on viewers, slipping edgy or even racist jokes into otherwise whimsical videos.
Did you know that Indians have poopo in their brains?
That's a blatant racist lie.
Yeah, but still a defamation.
Eventually, Jake stumbled upon the racist prankster Max Mofo, a white Australian YouTuber who calls up black people to mock them.
Yeah, listen, man, I came to McDonald's this time before I got like a burger.
Okay, I understand what you're saying, sir.
Listen, man, I came and got a burger.
Jake says that as he searched for other offensive comedians, YouTube began to suggest more political content.
I think we should start a petition, say, feminism must be classified as a mental illness.
Carl Benjamin, better known as Sargon of Akkad, is a smooth-talking right-wing commentator who tried to leverage his 900,000 subscribers in a losing bid for a European parliamentary seat earlier this year.
Carl Benjamin posted on Twitter that he wouldn't even rape Labour MP Jess Phillips. Today he said he wouldn't apologise for what he called his crimes against political correctness.
Radicalization on YouTube is a byproduct of its business model. The more time you spend viewing videos, the more money YouTube and its creators make. So, its algorithm queues up a list of related videos in a sidebar to keep you watching. This system can make it seem like fringe beliefs are more acceptable, more widely held than they are, by plunging the viewer into a deep well of extremist videos, each one leading to another. And the well gets darker the deeper you go. The videos the algorithm queued up for Jake eventually brought him to the really nasty white nationalist part of YouTube, where junk science is used to justify white superiority.
People who say that there really can't be any intellectual discrepancies between the races have a huge problem in terms of science.
Of course, plenty of people encounter racist things online without turning into racists. But Jake was at an especially vulnerable time in his life. He was struggling to reconcile his socially conservative upbringing with the realization that he's gay.
You go through this overcorrection of, I'm going to be the most absolute opposite form of that I can find. So yeah, I spent a lot of my middle teens being this overly macho, angry little fascist.
What interested me most about Jake's story was not how he fell down the rabbit hole. It was how he climbed out. His parents and high school teachers knew that he was going around saying horrible things about Jews and Muslims, waxing fondly on the legacy of Benito Mussolini. And they tried to intervene, but it was no use. Ultimately, what saved Jake was yet another YouTuber.
So, life is basically sad. And in capitalist society, that sadness is a sense of isolation, an anxiety that there's nothing more to life than acquiring 1990s collector's edition Tampa Bay Buccaneers / Slim Jim beer steins until you die. Fortunately, thanks to fascism, you don't have to.
Natalie Nguyen, better known by her YouTube moniker ContraPoints. Her videos are more like John Waters films than webcam vlogs. They're campily lit and costumed solo productions. Nguyen's impact on YouTube culture is so notable that the Library of Congress recently said it was archiving her entire channel.
Fascism promises you a part in something greater than yourself, a homeland for your people, a sense of belonging to a tradition that stretches back thousands of years.
In this video, called Decrypting the Alt-Right, she appears in sparkling red lipstick and wavy blonde hair, in front of floral wallpaper. Alternating empathy with irony, she describes why people fall for fascist propaganda. She's a 30-year-old trans woman, not someone you'd expect to win over a teenage white supremacist, but that's what happened to Jake.
This started off as hate watching, then it became, you know, I don't hate her, she's funny. And once you get rid of that hate, you can then start to actually listen to what she's saying. She goes about creating her videos in a very specific way. I couldn't tell you what it is about them, but you do not feel like you are being attacked. That's when I started to de-radicalize, so to speak, identifying less and less with right-wing ideology.
So what was that je ne sais quoi, that mysterious something that enabled her to defeat Jake's indoctrination? Well, it's partly location.
Young people are not watching MSNBC or CNN or Fox. They're watching YouTube.
Natalie Nguyen describes a great war on YouTube, going back the better part of a decade. A battle for the hearts and minds of millions of Gen Zers and millennials. Today, she's lauded as the matriarch of the left-wing offensive, a budding community known as LeftTube, or inexplicably, BreadTube.
Comfort ye, my subscribers, so saith your goddess, for it is I, the digital messiah.
LeftTube's most popular creators, ContraPoints, HBomberGuy, Sean, PhilosophyTube, and Lindsay Ellis, draw in hundreds of thousands of devoted subscribers and enough money to make a living. And they don't just talk about the far right. They make mini art films about video games and literature. Outlets like Vice, The New Yorker, and The LA Times have held up Natalie Nguyen and her cohort as an antidote to the political hate on YouTube. But she's not keen on that social media savior narrative. I was skeptical too, so I looked for proof. I interviewed 10 Gen Zers who credit ContraPoints and other LeftTubers with pulling them out of the alt-right rabbit hole. In fact, discovering LeftTube sometimes even sent them careening far in the other direction, towards Marxism and anarchism. So I asked Natalie Nguyen about that term de-radicalization, what people think it means and maybe what it really means. I think they imagine somebody who wakes up from being in a spell and their politics reset to the center.
Yes.
But what I've witnessed is more people swinging from the far right to the left.
That actually is a more typical story. People who have very centrist views suppose that they are the default. But oftentimes, if people are into far-right politics in the first place, it's because of some deep dissatisfaction they have with life in the modern world. Where the far left and the far right are in agreement are that society is drastically flawed and we need revolutionary or radical action to change things.
For the YouTube left, that's meant celebrating egalitarianism and calling out the ills of capitalism. And for the YouTube right, it's meant mocking the so-called social justice warriors who say those things.
I would like you to use my pronouns if you could. They're I, me, and mine.
So now you're mocking the LGBTQ community now.
I have lots of LGBTQ friends, and they don't get professionally offended at everything. There's male and there's female. There are two biological genders. Science exists.
People purporting to use facts and logic to debunk social justice warriors.
Meanwhile, Leftubers have become sophisticated storytellers, breaking down complex ideas using a popular format called the video essay.
That was really pioneered by people who do film criticism on YouTube, so people like Lindsay Ellis.
Lindsay Ellis is known for deeply researched essays on blockbusters, new and old, with a progressive take on character and plot.
All of the Guardians of the Galaxy conceit is about terrible people, made terrible by abuse, learning to care about society as a whole by learning to empathize with each other. None of these characters were born bad. These people can change.
Evan Heimbaugh, a 19-year-old white guy from Atlanta, told me that Ellis made him rethink propaganda he'd picked up from far-right YouTube. He'd grown up in a well-to-do libertarian household where there was little reflection on systemic inequality. Evan's transformation began with Lindsay Ellis' analysis of Peter, aka Star-Lord, a Guardians of the Galaxy character played by Chris Pratt.
Either one of you could have gotten us through that field, had you flown with what's between your ears instead of what's between your legs.
If what's between my legs had a hand on it, I guarantee I could have landed this ship with...
Peter, we almost died because of your arrogance.
One of the things that got to me was when she defined toxic masculinity as a theme in regards to Star-Lord's character growth. I kind of bristled a little bit because it's one of those terms that has this immediate visceral reaction, but then she goes to actually define the term.
The simplest way to describe it is men feeling the need to prove their perceived masculinity through unhealthy means, harmful to others, but just as often harmful to themselves.
That's when it kind of occurred to me that maybe some of the things I thought I knew weren't exactly true. So I started watching more of the media-centered bread tube content, and that was kind of my doorway into it.
Evan told me that the Guardians of the Galaxy essay made him cry. Once he'd watched a few more, the algorithm began recommending videos by other bread tube creators, a sort of reverse alt-right rabbit hole. ContraPoints introduced him to a variety of LGBTQ issues. H-Bomber Guy debunked Sargon's anti-SJW talking points. Sean helped him learn about how our current form of capitalism has hurt people of color. Now, Evan is a political organizer.
Politically, I'm an anarchist, so I was de-radicalized from the right, and then I was re-radicalized back to the left. At that point, my thought was, well, I can't just, like, not do anything. I have to, like, be politically active. So now I'm working on a campaign in Atlanta. We're trying to get the DeKalb County Jail shut down.
There's this assumption that logic will triumph. Well, I don't believe that.
Natalie Wynn.
I have, I suppose, a very dark view of how democracy works. This is it's a circus, not a forum. Narrative, spectacle, style is the real force of persuasion a lot of the time. And this is something I've heard from a number of people. My persona seemed unexpectedly cool and self-deprecating and edgy. In other words, just drastically the opposite of what you expect from a so-called social justice warrior. None of this has anything to do with logic or evidence.
The power of Wynn's aesthetic was in her ability to build and strengthen what many internet commentators call the parasocial relationship. The illusion that we viewers really know our YouTube stars, that we can, video by video, pick up on their hopes and fears.
I know that there are times when I just want to die.
That's Oliver Thorne, the face and mind of a channel called Philosophy Tube, telling the story of a really dark time in his life. The video is difficult to watch, but really compelling. He told me that his feel for narrative and presentation come from his theater background.
Peter Brook has this concept of dead theater. It's technically very good, and all the acting's great, and the script is great, and so on, but it doesn't shake you, it doesn't move you or motivate anybody to do anything. And he says the missing ingredient, what dead theater lacks, is what is expensive. People want to see something that costs you something to produce, something that is brave or raw.
This notion of cost helped me understand the success of LeftTube's single biggest spectacle of the year and the effect it had on one woman.
When I came to college and I saw people that were a little alternative, I was like, oh my God, I am beset on all sides by shaved head, rainbow hair, SJWs. And I spent the whole time waiting for someone to put me in free speech prison, and it didn't happen. That caused a little bit of cognitive dissonance.
Joan's a college student from Nova Scotia, Canada. She was at a crappy, depressed moment in her teens when she started watching anti-SJW videos. She didn't know it at the time, but they really shaped how she saw the world. Joan would troll gun reform activists just to let off steam, spending like 10 hours a day on 4chan. She came across some left tube videos, but mostly dismissed them because, well, they're a bunch of social justice warriors. That is, until she learned about...
It's time for the Donkey Kong 64 nightmare stream.
That was the turning point for me.
Harry Brewis, known as H-Bomber Guy on YouTube, told his 400,000 subscribers that he would broadcast his play of this excruciatingly long vintage video game on Twitch, the live streaming platform.
He was going to play in its entirety on stream Donkey Kong 64.
To raise money for a UK charity that had attracted a lot of ire in the British press.
All the proceeds from this stream will go to Mermaids, a charity which works to provide resources and support to young people with gender dysphoria. Because as a person living in Britain, I find the media discussion surrounding this issue in my country, especially in its tabloids, to be woefully misinformed.
The controversy is a little bit like the Planned Parenthood funding debate here in the US. Last year, a group of conservative activists pressured the government to withdraw funding from the Mermaids charity. So the Twitch stream starts on January 18th, 2019, for 59 hours straight. Here we go. During the stream, you can see the cost of the stunt on H-Bomber Guy's sleep-deprived face. Meanwhile, Natalie Wynn, Oliver Thorne, and a bunch of activists call in to share their own experiences and support the cause.
Because I remember from, like, parenting a trans kid, how many people just said to me, well, can't you just make him be a boy? And I'm like, no, you're not getting it. She's a girl.
Live donations flood the screen. $5, $100, $500.
I think he expected to raise, like, £1,000. Yeah, the stream absolutely took off. And after 24 hours, he'd raised, like, 30 grand. After, like, 48 hours, it had raised even more money. And then Chelsea Manning came on the stream.
Update, oh, Chelsea what? Is here.
What?
Chelsea Manning is here.
What?
And then Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez came on the stream.
It's a no-brainer. Trans rights are civil rights are human rights.
Woo! Thank you so much for saying
that. And by the end of it, we raised almost $400,000. And I think Harry broke the world record for the most amount of money ever raised by streaming a video game.
Meanwhile, Joan is like having her mind blown. After the stream, she posted on an LGBTQ forum with a message about some confusing feelings.
I tend to like envy girls a lot or whatever and feel very self-conscious about my broad shoulders. A few people replied. One person linked a subreddit called r/eggIRL.
EggIRL, as in egg in real life, is a forum on Reddit with 37,000 users dedicated to memes about trans people coming to grips with their gender identity.
The term egg is trans terminology for a closeted trans person. It was the firsthand experience of trans people told to me through the art of memes. And if that is not something from the 21st century, I'm not sure what is. I spent hours just scrolling through the subreddit looking at memes going, oh God, I'm trans, aren't I?
Joan has just started coming out to her friends at school and says her goal is to fully perceive herself as a woman. Inspired by ContraPoints, she switched her major to journalism so she can learn the skills to start her own channel.
What Natalie has done with her channel is inspiring, and I would like to make videos that people find convincing and could help them if they're in a situation similar to mine.
Joan shows the impact of YouTubers like Natalie Wynn. She and the larger left-tube movement have thrown an escape rope to those who've slipped down the alt-right rabbit hole. But Wynn says she's ready for her channel ContraPoints to evolve.
It's just a very different world than we were in 2 years ago. No one took YouTube politics seriously. There's a million videos about all these topics. We've got this covered. There's so many people working on it now. I haven't mentioned the alt-right in a video in more than a year now. Where are they? After Charlottesville, they completely lost the momentum of the neo-Nazi wing of the whole thing. The prominent alt-light journalist Lauren Southern just announced that she's leaving public life. We have Alex Jones banned across most platforms. We have this like strong left-tube presence that has, in a lot of ways, surpassed some of the right-wing creators. So it's just a very different situation.
Left-tubers understand their audience and how they consume information far better than mainstream journalists do. They don't have the reflex of TV news to cover the outrage of white supremacy by extending their platform to it. Like on Tuesday, when CNN interviewed Richard Spencer on national TV, suggesting why his ideas are bad, while sharing them with millions. Natalie Wynn and other left-tubers have no journalistic training. They don't answer to a newsroom editor or journalism's unshakable faith in logic and evidence. But when it comes to fighting fascism, they seem to have it figured out. For On the Media, I'm Michael Loewinger.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Micah Loewinger, Leah Fetter, John Hanrahan, Astha Chaturvedi, and Zandra Ellen. We had more help from Chloe Nosan. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.